Hello everyone and welcome to the EdTech Podcast, the show dedicated to improving the dialogue between ed and tech for better innovation. My name is Sophie Bailey and this week we are in Takeover with MapleSoft to explore the benefits and challenges of online education. Online education has seemingly exploded in recent years and is a staple subject on the EdTech podcast. We've looked at online tutoring with the CEO of VIP Kids, Cindy Mai, in episode 83, and we've reviewed higher education and MOOCs with Class Central and FutureLearn CEOs in episode 67. But how much is really changing on the ground for universities and colleges? The aspirations of UK body FELTAG, or the Further Education Learning Technology Action Group, to have 50% of teaching online by 2017 in the UK were never really met and now seem wildly ambitious. Among UK universities, the introduction of the Teaching Excellence and Student Outcomes Framework Specification, or TEF, in 2016 has placed emphasis on student learning and student outcomes as opposed to purely research excellence. In this newer context, TEF Gold, the highest standard, is awarded to those which recognise the following aspects of quality: teaching quality, learning environment, and student outcomes and learning gain. Where does online fit in with all of this? Well, it doesn't dominate, but it does feature. Teaching quality refers to seminars, tutorials, project supervision, laboratory sessions, studio time, placements, supervised online learning, workshops, fieldwork, and site visits. The emphasis is on teaching that provides an appropriate level of contact, stimulation, and challenge, and which encourages student engagement and effort. Outstanding physical and digital resources are those which are recognised to be actively and consistently used by students to enhance learning, and if we look at one of the TEF Gold Standard universities, Coventry, their report shows that they used a comprehensive and embedded approach to personalised learning, which maximised rates of retention, attainment and progression. They also used outstanding physical and digital resources which pervaded all aspects of student experience, including state-of-the-art integration of learner analytics, student support and timetabling. But how pervasive is this experience? I still hear university insiders vent their frustration against massive budgets immediately spent on bricks and mortar lecture halls instead of expanding online learning opportunities. Should we be concerned about this? In this episode, I chat to a provider, Jim Cooper, MapleSoft's president and CEO, and another gold standard TEF university, represented by Nicola Wilkin, the Director of Education at the College of Engineering and Physical Sciences at the University of Birmingham, to explore the challenges and opportunities of online teaching and learning. First up, here's Jim from MapleSoft. First of all, could you tell us a little bit about MapleSoft and how you came to work in this space?
Sure. MapleSoft began as a research project at the University of Waterloo in the early 80s. So roughly when computers became powerful enough to do symbolic mathematics, so it could work with symbols as opposed to simply crunching numbers, Maple was developed as a computer algebra system. It became incredibly popular, in fact, so popular that in 1988, it had to become a company just so it could hire a shipper to actually ship out the product. And it has a very high rate of penetration or usage in mathematical departments around the world. So, north of 90% usage, and Maple had been used as a teaching tool. So, about 10 years ago, we developed a product that allowed instructors to automatically generate online examinations and to automatically mark those examinations, at least examinations which were mathematically based. And that's used extensively in the STEM disciplines, anyone that uses mathematics. And that then just naturally led to us supplementing that online testing with the ability of capturing online course material, what we call digital assets. It's changing now, but online seemed to, in the past, indicate that the student was off campus. And now, more and more, the on-campus students also make use of these digital assets throughout the teaching process. So it seemed like a very natural progression for us to move into delivering an environment for the creation and deployment of these digital assets. And the key advantage, of course, is that we use the underlying symbolic math engine, so it's very conversant and understands mathematical concepts. So it allows you to, you know, test students in real time and do automatic marking, so you don't have to wait for an instructor to mark an examination. So it can have a very tight feedback loop. So in a nutshell, that's how we came to online learning.
That's very interesting. And when did you join in the MapleSoft story? Were you there in the beginning when it was university-based, or did you join later on?
I've been here for an embarrassing long period of time, but I became involved as an investor in sort of the dot-com year, so the late 1999. But I'm an engineer by background. Originally, there were two professors who had started the company, and I helped one of them exit and came into the company. But very much, I got hooked by the technology, and I've been here now, going on 20 years.
Amazing. And where are you guys based as well?
We're based in Waterloo still. We have offices around the world, one in Cambridge in the UK, a couple other in Europe and Germany and France, also Japan, China, Australia. But the core of the development is within a bike ride still from the University of Waterloo. And we greatly depend on their co-op education system for many of our, we'll say, long-term interviews. And we still hire a huge number of graduates from the University of Waterloo.
So this week's episode is about the benefits and challenges of online education. So from your perspective, how have you worked through what you think are the benefits and also the slightly more complex parts of it as well?
Well, we've been sort of involved heavily for the last 10 years and have worked with some major university partners where their goal was to be a leader in we'll say, digital education. So it's been a nice ringside seat where we could see how the attitude has changed. Very much when online education first became, you know, truly used, it was very much about scalability, flexibility, convenience, you know, that you could take a course from any location at any time, and extremely flexible, and of course, more cost-effective. In the last number of years, say in the last 5 years, we've seen a real shift, which I think is a very good shift, that it's more than just about convenience and scalability and cost-effectiveness, that it truly has to be a better educational experience. You know, for the use of digital assets should improve the educational experience, improve student outcomes. So it's more than just making it more flexible and saving expenses.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I remember one of the earlier episodes of the podcast, I spoke with a professor from MIT, and his concern was that EdTech generally, that it not become like a chase to the bottom about value, and that it actually, you know, needs to be sort of more proactive than that.
Yeah, you should see better student outcomes. You should see more engagement from students, you know, with heavy use of digital assets. You should be hopefully be able to teach more in less time. You should have a better insight to how your students are progressing through the material. So there should be numerous benefits.
And from a kind of international point of view, you know, obviously with your offices internationally, are you seeing any difference in how online strategies are working, for example, between North America and the UK or rest of world? I was just wondering if there are any lessons that we could learn in terms of how things are being picked up or being deployed internationally as well.
I guess our general sense would be that Europe as a whole seems to be leading. We definitely see, I think, more enlightened attitudes based in Europe. As you know, there's a very different method of paying for university education between Europe and North America. But I would say that North America is a close follower, but they seem to be driven by slightly different criteria, where Europe, I think, is a bit further along in trying to improve the student experience and outcomes. And North America might still be on the scalability and, as you said, race to the bottom from a cost point of view. But I do think that attitude is changing. I would say put Europe still in a lead position, but closely followed by North America. Our other big market is China, where we have sort of extensive usage of digital assets. And it's a nice combination. Definitely, they're very challenged because they're of the sheer number of students, and they've had a massive buildup and huge level of investment. China is investing an order of magnitude more money in at least STEM education, the area that we have a good view into, than both North America and Europe. So the amount of investment in recent years, and a lot of that has been translated out to development of digital assets and deployment of digital assets. So China is, again, I would still say in a third position, but the rate of change is maybe double the rate of change in North America and Europe.
What about some of the most impressive and innovative partner projects you have with universities? So I'm sure there's a variance in terms of actually implementing online strategy. So what have you seen?
Well, I mean, we have a number of, maybe a good example is where we came from, the University of Waterloo. They have one of the larger math and computer science departments in the world. I think they're rated in the top 30, and they have over 7,000 undergraduate students. And they have an interesting environment that they came to online development of online digital assets very early, maybe 10 years ago. But the issues that they ran into were interesting. They found that the creation of the material, even though it was meaningful, it was not as much of a challenge as maintaining the digital assets. And part of that is the feedback cycle. Previously publishing, as you know well from your background, had maybe, let's say, a five-year cycle. You know, you would publish a textbook, you would slowly gain maybe some comments on it as it was used, and you would do a new edition. And it might, definitely the feedback cycle was measured in years. And they, like many other institutions today, when they deploy digital assets, quite often the feedback cycle can be measured in hours or days, where the system will be able to measure different components and be able to flag where students are maybe spending too much time or not enough time or their low success rate. And they can actually go in and revamp that material and see how it works for the next cohort or the next class that uses it. So the maintainability with this fast feedback cycle, and like University of Waterloo is an example, they teach a first-year calculus course to the entire university. So it's one course, but they actually have 26 different departments which use it. So they teach calculus to math and to engineering and to science. And they found that, even though a lot of the material was the same, you wanted to give engineers a different example if you were teaching them limits compared to science students, compared to math students. So the cost of maintaining the digital asset and have this constant improvement cycle, they found to be much more major than the initial development of the materials. And I think that's a bit of a mind shift just on how the content is developed. It's never done. It's constantly being improved.
And there's the sort of archiving and the tagging and the multiple data points you have with that. And I imagine that part of making it a success is having the systems in place to deal with that kind of tsunami of information.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And even more so to change the attitudes of educators, of professors who they're very used to, for a very long period of time, of doing a 40, 50-minute lecture series, which has a start to an end. And most digital materials, for a number of reasons, one is maintainability, one is being able to update little sections, and even student attention span. A huge amount of research shows items in a much smaller time frame work better, you know, so minutes, you know, versus hours or an hour. And if you can have components which have a much shorter duration, A, they're easier to maintain, they're easier to update. Students, if they're having a problem with a particular section, they don't have to scrub through a 40-minute lecture. They can actually search and find that one component that they're having trouble with and review that quickly. So there's a number of advantages making things shorter or more containerized. So you have these learning objects that are probably don't span over 5 minutes, might even be a maximum. And then you can string these together to develop a course. That has worked very well.
And have you found any successful ways of shifting to that way of doing things? So, for example, where the universities that you work with that have done that well, have they got a particular person in place that's responsible for maintaining that, or is there a kind of a formulaic way of approaching that that seems to work, or what have you seen in terms of success around moving to that more fast-paced environment?
Well, I'll answer the question sort of in two parts. Definitely the campuses that we've worked with that have a separate support department in developing digital assets. So, you know, they would have a group of people that would support educators when they're developing the digital materials, and they become experts, we'll say, in methods of education, especially methods of developing and utilizing digital assets. So that has worked extremely well compared to where it's all on the professor. And there's a huge range of knowledge and abilities in professors developing digital materials. And more, probably just as importantly at the, you know, university higher level, it makes it very hard to share components between courses or between professors. But if you have a common, we'll say, digital asset factory or support group, they can bring some commonality. And that pays huge dividends in the ability of reusing components and updating components and sharing data between professors, between courses and departments. So definitely having a group. But the other item that I think, you know, people quite often we talk about what's going to change education, you know, what's going to improve it. And digital assets, yeah, there's some advantages. You know, they can be interactive. You know, they can have very rich animation and graphics. They can have embedded testing, and they can be adaptive to the students' needs. So people, you know, each student can have their own path through the materials. Those are all good things. But by themselves, I don't think will really make education better. You know, what will make education better, and I think this might be the major shift that we're beginning to see, is that I think for the first time in maybe the history of education, you can truly begin to measure education. You can begin measuring how effective it is. Now, it's true we can't look into students' brains yet and you know, say, okay, do you have this concept well understood? But By testing continuously through the process, as well as summative testing at the end, by seeing how much time is being spent, by seeing how long the students are engaged with the materials, we can get a much better measurement than we've ever had before. There's a very good book called Reengineering the University by William Massey, where I think he talks about, you know, that once we have sort of learning objects in place, that will be awash in data. And I would say that's exactly where we are now. We are awash, like awash with data of how individual students move through the material, or how classes move through. And we're using artificial intelligence techniques, because it's a lot of data, to, you know, develop indicators of where are the learning breakdowns, where are the materials they should be improved. And we can get a handle on measuring the education process. So I would argue that that's probably the first time since, you know, for hundreds of years that we've truly have begun to measure the education process. And there's an old management saying that you don't get what you expect, you get what you measure. And I think we're at the dawn of measuring education. And once you can measure it, you can, you know, do a, like an A-B test. You can see what works better, it doesn't work better. You can actually, you can support if you know, professors and educators are, they have lots of opinions, you know, like they, as a group, there's no lack of opinions. But to back up those opinions with measured data, to say, you know, is this method better or is, you know, method B better? And for the first time, I think we can do that. So I think what's going to change education, yes, we have a digital assets can be richer and more interactive and better, but that by itself won't change the game, I would say. What I think will change the game will be measurements and analytics applied to constantly improving these materials. So I think that's what excites me moving into the future, getting better at having education measured.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting going beyond the sort of cult of personality of a particular professor. But yeah, and I think then actually using those analytics, but having that force of personality or educator to really, you know, lift people and inspire them as well.
Oh, and absolutely. And I think you would see that in the measurements, right? Like, so the rock star educator, I think, you know, you can actually measure that that is more effective. And I think, you know, for example, that their materials will probably then be able to bubble to the top. And what's good about education, a lot of these materials get shared, you know, even amongst institutions. So you could see that over a period of time, the very best materials, the most effective, you know, best student outcome materials will bubble to the top and will have higher usage.
And I think Facebook and Elon Musk are investing in being able to reduce the cost of brain scans to see what a student is and whether they understand a concept or not. But moving to the present day, part of all this, so the next question I had, so in the UK, we have the Teaching Excellence Framework Initiative, and there are rumblings about universities moving to micro degrees or part online to make things more financially viable for students. But it is all very slow. So I just wondered whether there were any other international government initiatives or university sector initiatives which you've seen, which are helping to support online education and also university professionals that are out there that are sort of spearheading this that listeners might learn from.
Well, I mean, I guess I think it's wonderful that people are actually looking at new ways, you know, that yeah, and as you know well, especially in North America, because we see the cost of education a little bit more clearly with the student paying more. The cost of education has increased, I think, 7-8 times over the cost of inflation. And that is clearly not sustainable. You know, you do have to decide whether education is a service or whether it's a business. But if you saw that in a business, you would say, well, this business is ripe for disruption. And I think we're seeing different ways of potentially providing education. And I think that's a very rich environment. But I would come back to what's going to make that work and not work is the measurement aspect. So whether micro degrees actually work, I think the nice thing with that is that we can hopefully have better measurement and that, you know, employers would get used to the concept of seeing that measurement in place. I do think we have to be careful. And again, as you, I think you know well, much of the educational experience isn't just about learning the materials. You know, if we could magically just embed the materials in people's brains, that would be great. But it is, you know, building that network of thinkers, being able to teach critical thinking generally, so you can apply those questioning and critical thinking skills to new problems and new concepts. So I do think that the educational experience is more than just the data being transferred. But I do think that we should, I mean, over probably be a decade, 5 years to a decade, that we'll get better at measuring the results of that and improve it along the way. So I think all these items are good. I don't think I have an opinion on what is going to work, except the fact that I will put more trust in something that is makes a real attempt at measuring the effectiveness and the outcome versus something which is just opinion.
And are you seeing like a shift towards taking on board student opinion more seriously than previously in the kind of college and school sector? Because here I think that we have this term customer, and a lot of the universities don't like that because, you know, traditionally it's more research focused, whereas now actually student feedback, satisfaction surveys and that kind of thing are becoming increasingly more important, I think, and a part of the arsenal of a student's decision making process as well.
That's true, and I think that's all a good thing. I will make the comment that, especially as far as digital assets, the students are the converted ones. If anyone is lagging behind, it might be the educators. They're truly digital natives. Most surveys that we've looked at, the majority of students prefer a more heavily online experience. Like they are, as I said, digital natives. There's no resistance here. On a very like micro basis, we've also found that once you have the ability of students to like and dislike particular pieces of the content, that's a very good measure. I mean, we never had the ability. I mean, a student could, you know, at the end of a course would maybe do a rating, whether you liked that course or didn't like that course. But now the measurement can be much more fine grained. He can measure, I don't like the way limits were taught, you know, this little component here, and he can sort of like it or not like. And I think that type of student feedback, which is very fine grained, will also shape how content is presented and how it's developed. So I think bottom line, education has to become more effective, in higher student engagement, has to become more effective in cost. There has to be some, I mean, billions of dollars are spent in education. There has to be some proof to who's paying for it, whether it's the students or their parents or a government agency, that education is actually being delivered. And I see, you know, that process be having a lot more data to work with in the near future.
It's like lifting the veil slightly.
Exactly, as opposed to just opinion. It's nothing like having measurable data.
It's definitely an engineer in there somewhere.
I'm sorry, yes, I do have that tendency.
No, it's good. So final question then, Jim. What are your favorite resources, people, Twitter accounts or other books? I know you mentioned one earlier that you would recommend to people if they're interested in this space as well to go off and read up more on.
A book I've enjoyed was Reengineering the University, William Massey. So that was very good. And also, we have a number of podcasts where we at MapleSoft, I mean, we try to make it sure there's no product or marketing involved. We're really just trying to talk to people and their opinions on truly implementing good courses, good digital content. And it's called futuredigitaleducation.com. And the Twitter handle is @futuredigitaled, all one word. So encourage people, if they're interested, to look at some of these. And really is more just examples and experiences that different educators, universities, colleges around the world have had as they try to make that transition from where they are today or yesterday to a fully supported digital asset environment.
Thanks, Jim. But what's it really like on the ground? Let's chat to Nicola Wilkin, the Director of Education at the College of Engineering and Physical Sciences at the University of Birmingham in the UK to find out more.
Hello.
So first up, our listeners are from all around the world. Can you tell us a little bit about where the University of Birmingham sits in terms of specialism, scale and history, and, you know, perhaps what the focus of the university has been in the past and what the vision is as we move forward as well?
So Birmingham's the UK's second city. It's about an hour and a half north of London. And it's very much in the centre of the UK. It was founded as a civic university just over 100 years ago. And that means that it was founded to welcome students from all religions and backgrounds on an equal basis. It's got a pretty broad base of subjects that we undertake. So we have a large medical school, social sciences, business school, big life and environmental sciences, and then the college that I'm a part of and that I lead the education strategy on covers engineering and physical sciences. And by background, I'm a theoretical physicist, so I've worked a lot with computers in the past, done a lot of computer algebra, so you'll see some commonalities with things that, Jim may have been talking about. And I've been really using the research aspects of my work, pulling those into being able to do the educational delivery.
So that's really interesting, because I know, yeah, so your focus is, you know, if we're using some of the buzzwords of the moment around STEM, and that will be the same for lots of people listening in. What have you found both in your research and in applying that even for what online can offer someone, you know, with a STEM specialism? And then perhaps after that, we can go into the university's broader online strategy and how the two might interplay as well.
So within the STEM disciplines, we found that the online is incredibly useful in becoming familiar or revising techniques. So things where really becoming fluent as well as having that deeper knowledge are great benefits. So setting sort of materials, active materials to work with in that part. So I've now got sort of a team of developers working across the college and increasingly the university. So at the moment it's two physics PhDs and one chemistry. So they've got a really deep knowledge of the disciplines, a curiosity to learn other areas, as well as that bug of one real sort of wish to understand how they can use the technology to enhance the education, to make sure it's really the education, the pedagogy we're pushing on rather than making it gimmicky.
And so some sort of practical examples of what you've been doing, is that around, you know, actually being able to manipulate when we're talking about chemistry, or can you give us an idea of how that exactly plays out as well?
So it may be that you're learning, let's say, a particular part of engineering or physics, and that then requires you to call upon mathematical areas that perhaps you did in an earlier year. It then gives you sort of quick fire sort of questions which you can go through and pull together the various strands that may have been taught to you in different courses, such that you can see them represented as a whole rather than relearning the whole aspect.
Oh, interesting. So taking modules of earlier courses rather than having to go back and, you know, go through in a linear fashion the whole course content again.
Absolutely. So we've set things up such that they're in smallish modules and you can pick out the bits that you need at any particular point. What's more, because we're setting it as a centralized aspect within the whole university, you may have been taught a particular technique from, say, a physics or chemistry perspective, but you can now go ahead and be curious and understand the greater implications for areas outside of those that you're studying.
So that's interesting, because we've talked about on the podcast before the sort of modularization of higher education, or, you know, unpacking degrees. But this sounds like quite a practical example of, you know, where that's been quite useful and also how it allows for more cross-curricular learning as well. Is that a sort of trend that you're seeing more broadly outside of the science subjects, or do you have any thoughts on that kind of move as well?
So most of the science subjects are, as you say, at least at their core, quite hierarchical in terms of the knowledge base that you need to work through, you need to become familiar with. But as you start developing, for instance, particularly in research projects, including at an undergraduate level, you need to be able to hop between areas and create links that might not naturally fit within those modules. And having those underlying resources laid out in a way that you can pull them together, you can then see who it is that actually taught them within your university, and you have the opportunity to actually then do the blended learning of saying, right, I've worked through those questions, I've got some ideas, thoughts, and you can go and speak to that particular researcher or lecturer in a different discipline.
And is that sort of student-led? So, for example, can a student decide what extra modules they'd like to pull in, or is it already laid out within the online framework?
At the moment, these materials would not be for credit materials other than for the projects. But yes, they can do extra if they wish.
How about from the university's sort of wider online strategy? I don't know if what you're doing and your own developments kind of feed into a kind of wider online strategy, and whether you have any insight on, you know, how that's being reached and how it's being deployed, because obviously we always have the vision and then it's the practicalities of implementing it that are sometimes throw up the most interesting situations, shall we say.
So the university's online strategy is very much for the education delivery, set using sort of Canvas, which is our VLE, as a backbone. And one of its major advantages for this is that it's pretty easy to connect other applications which are maybe needed for particular technical purposes. So, for instance, for the Maple TA and Mobius, they will be accessed through that VLE, and we can carry on adding in as we need to. Makes it very easy for the students, makes it quite easy for the staff because they can see what they can work with. Why do we need to make this consistent? Well, we're in the process of setting up a campus in Dubai, which will open in September of this year. And we want to enable as much of the blended learning and for students to be able to cross between those two campuses, at least electronically.
Very interesting. And for you, what's the most exciting bit about that? And, you know, what keeps you up at night sometimes when you're thinking about, you know, perhaps what you'd like to do next or any of the challenges as well?
So I think one of the big challenges that we have at the moment, or opportunity, depending on my particular frame of mind of where we've hit in the project, is that on site in Birmingham Edgbaston, we're going to open a new collaborative teaching laboratory this September. So it's really designed to enable students to work together across the science disciplines. So this is life and environmental science, as well as the engineering and physical sciences. And what we put together is an EdTech strategy, which will take them pretty seamlessly from before the lab. So the pre-lab, the lab, and the post-lab all set up in a structure where they can access materials. They can work with not just their data, but the data from other students as well in real time. So we think we've got the pilots of that working, but actually rolling that out at scale is definitely a nighttime worry.
And is the scale part more problematic because it's, you know, training people on the system and just communicating how it works, or, you know, what's it about scaling it up that makes it more tricky?
I think none of the parts are individually difficult, but as we get more and more innovative, the number of parts that could potentially go wrong increases, and just making sure that we keep a hold on people's imagination and sort of take it through in a stepwise manner.
Yeah, sounds like I'm sure you could get carried away otherwise. Cool. Final question. So what are your top tips for other university professionals listening in? And do you have any go-to resources, so whether that's Twitter chats or books, online blogs, people or associations, you'd like to share with them that you'd found useful as you've gone through this process as well?
So one of the things that we've been doing in Birmingham, which has enabled us to progress pretty fast, is that we've been working with pretty large teams of student interns. So this is sort of during their summer break. They've been doing maybe 8 weeks with us, where they've been learning to work with lecturers, understand which bits that they could transfer into online material, and essentially co-creating such that they're setting up in a way that their peers would find useful. So that's given us a large question bank. And the other thing it's done is that we've been very careful about the quality assurance, such that the lecturers have come back and said, well, you know, it's as good as anything that I could have got commercially. Please, can you do this for me next summer? So I think that's one thing that's enabled us to do that, because often one ends up with just a few questions. The students get used to using a system and then they've exhausted the materials that you have there.
It's very cool. Anything else or any other bits you'd like to add? Or
yeah, so people that I enjoy reading, so I think Athene Donald's blog on Occam's Razor is something that I'd recommend reading for sort of insights into academia and the world in general from someone that's really thinking about it. So that would be a recommendation. And the other thing that I find as an academic very useful to read is actually reading The Economist, because very often there are parallels in the sort of the commercial IT issues and sort of having insight as to how they solved them and how we could parallel that in the education sector.
Perfect. Yeah, I love a bit of The Economist. So, Nicola, thank you so much. Thanks for coming on the show.
And thank you very much for talking.
That's the end of this week's episode. Want to leave feedback? Tweet us at Podcast EdTech and at MapleSoft and at Nicola_Quantum, Quantum, or check out the MapleSoft page at www.maplesoft.com, where you can also find more content and case studies. I'll drop that link, show notes and more at www.theedtechpodcast.com. Big thank you to all our guests. And if you enjoyed this week's discussion on online learning, do go and check out episodes 90 to 95, which include a fully online peer-to-peer learning experience with the head of pedagogy at Ecole 42, plus recently awarded Computing's Female CIO of the Year, Heidi Fraser-Krause, on moving to the cloud at the University of York. Thanks for listening in and have a great week.